should we get going?
Yeah. So, what's your favorite guitar chord?
I don't know anything about guitars, so
Google would differ on that point.
So,
oh,
the guy is
sorry.
Yes. That guy is the bane of my Google PageRank existence.
He really is.
I'll never be number one. And for those that are out there, there is another Joe Stump, and he is a reasonably famous shredding metal guitarist who is a tenured professor who teaches shredding at Berklee School of Music and releases. Yeah. He literally teaches guitar shredding at Berklee School of Music.
That's hilarious.
Have you ever met him, Joe? It sounds like you know a bit about him.
No, so in like 9th, 10th grade, I had a friend of mine that was like way into guitars and like grew his hair out and he was going to be a rock and roll star someday. And he brought one of his guitar magazines in and like one of Joe Stump's Night of the Living Shred albums was being advertised in it. And he was like, I had no idea that you were like an amazing famous guitarist. And I was like, I didn't either. Yeah.
Surprise.
He's also why I don't own joestump.com. That's all right. I got stu.mp in the end. So I think I
saw that. Yeah. That's awesome.
I could always ask, did you give him an offer? Did you like say, hey, I'll give you?
I did. I offered him joestump.net and $5,000 and he turned me down cold. Yeah, I tried.
I hate that. It's always the hardest process getting the amazing. Anyhow, I just remembered actually, Joe, have you pressed record on your end? Because not that we need it, Blab will send us an audio file.
It says that it's recording.
It's good. That's fine. I think we'll go with the lab recording.
Yeah, we'll be fine.
Perfect. Okay.
All right.
Well, so Joe is not the Joe Stump of shredding fame. No. Though I have no doubt, given your intelligence, that you could easily pick it up. But Joe, at least according to your bio and your LinkedIn profile, you are the co-founder of Sprintly, of Simple Geo, and of attachments.me.
That's another one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
many more other things prior to that.
Yeah, and then as Cal was filling me in, you were a lead engineer, correct, at Dig?
Yep.
And what was the other?
And another long time ago.
Yeah.
Days of Yore.
Days of Yore. Yeah, I left Dig. God, 7 years ago.
I was listening to another podcast that I listened to called Design Details, and they had an interview with Daniel Burka.
Oh yeah.
Currently at Google Ventures, one of the designers there, and I assume you must have crossed paths with him.
Yeah, I know Daniel really well. He, him and I were good buds when we were in San Francisco, and he's actually off traveling now. He's in Tokyo right now. Oh, making me really jealous. Yeah, he's on like a 2 or 3 month sabbatical from Google Ventures, I think, right now. And,
okay.
And he's co-authoring a book on agile design practices that I think is coming out soon. So yeah.
I would be very interested in reading this book.
Yeah.
That's basically what he does for Google Ventures. He kind of parachutes into all their different teams and does design sprints around kind of product challenges and UX challenges that they're having.
Yeah.
So based on that history though, Joe, like just for the background, like, and I don't think I even know this, what got you started into the first thing that you did and kind of paved the start of where you kind of are now today?
Well, I started programming on my T85 calculator in 8th grade. And that's really kind of what I ended up making programs that would show your work. So the T85 had a thing where you could say Y equals MX plus B, and this is what like Y and X is. So tell me what M is, but it wouldn't show you the steps. And so you wouldn't get credit. You could verify your answer, but you couldn't get the actual steps to actually get the full credit. And so I made an app that did that. And then went around and sold it to people for lunch money. So that was probably the first software I sold was T85 cheat software.
And that was completely bootstrapped, I presume. No angel, no angel funding.
I took a dollar on about a $5 post.
Yeah.
No, it was definitely bootstrapped. But my first professional, I ended up when I really kind of got serious about web programming. I had a buddy of mine tell me about PHP 3 that had just come out back before, right after they had changed the name from PHP FI, for those that are old enough to remember such shenanigans. This was before PHP had dedicated get in post variables. So like it literally just dropped everything into, it was terrible. Oh, wow. So I started working at a local computer shop. I met them at a Linux users group that they hosted. I met the guy that ran the e-commerce site, and that was my first real paid programming job.
What drew you, like what about that experience, kept you engaged? Was it the intellectual challenge of doing the work, or was it the collaboration you have with the people you're working with, or
sure?
I was mostly a solo dude for probably the first 5 or 6 years of my career, but so it wasn't so much that. I really like, so my dad was a home builder and an architect growing up, and so I like building things. That's what him and I spent a lot of time doing growing up, was building things and tearing cars apart and, you know, replacing heating systems and shit like that. And I ended up, I just really enjoy building stuff. And I also like, for whatever reason, I like reading a lot. I like learning new things a lot, and I like puzzles. So that's a good programming it was.
Yeah. So yeah. As you programmed away, when was it the first shift away from programming into either, I'm assuming here, right? Like when was the first intrigue to get into startup land or founding of a company or getting into the product side of things? Or, you know, were there moments that you remember as a story? Like, actually at that point, I realized I wanted to get more into understanding how the money part worked or the product.
Yeah. I'm a weird computer programmer, in that I did not get a CS degree. I got a what's that?
You got a degree in shredding?
I wish. No, I got a degree in I got a degree in business. Sorry, I got an email from Blab and I thought they were saying something about illegalness, but it's not. I got a degree in business. So I'm a weird computer programmer in that I've always had an interest in the business side. My parents were both entrepreneurs. Like I said, my dad started his own construction business and ran that for years. My mom had her own salon and ran that for years as well. So there was never a question in my mind that I was going to start my own business growing up. It was just a matter of like what it was going to be and how I was going to start it. That's always been really, you know, a kind of a quick key tenant in the family. But as far as kind of getting more into the product side of things, that was probably at Enotes. It was a really, really slim team. The two founders were not technical at all. One of them had taught themselves how to program using the Sam's 24-hour guidebook. He actually had a law degree. The other guy had an English degree. And so they didn't really know what was possible with the tech. And so it wasn't even like product. It was more like, guys, there's like, we can do a whole bunch of cool stuff. And this is all the different cool stuff we could do. And then it was just more like, okay, well, we like that and go do that. That was also when I first had to hire people. That was really kind of the first time where I would say I had one leg in management and one leg in code. Cause like I helped Brad find the office. I got all of the contractors put in place for that. Spun up a NOC, racked and stacked servers for them, hired the first three technical people there. So that was probably the first time that I really started doing management stuff. And I guess ostensibly I always did product stuff there, but it wasn't product in the way that we think of it now. It was like, this is the stuff you could do if we wanted to program it. And they're like, all right, cool. That sounds good.
That's the way it was back then, right? Everything was and everything, anything could have been like a solution, and it didn't need to be validated. It was just the first time being done, right?
Yeah, and I mean, keep it. I mean, I started working on eNotes in 2001 or two, and so things were a lot different back then on the internet, right? And they didn't have subscriptions. You couldn't check out with more than one item in your shopping cart. They didn't have recommendations, a couple other things. So a lot of the stuff that I did for the first couple of years was just like, all right, well, let's allow people to log in and look at their older orders and stuff like that. Yeah.
Basic stuff that we really take for granted then.
Yeah. I mean, people forget that we had to invent SSL because some yo-yo had the bright idea to like collect credit cards over CGI bin, right? And CGI bins were literally, we were just like, well, if you put an executable into this special directory, we'll just run it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I know.
What year was that invented?
SSL. SSL.
Early mid-90s.
Okay.
I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had my fair share of blackboards and CGI pull scripts.
Yeah, 94.
Okay.
Yeah. It was invented by Netscape and is now considered not something you want to use. It's been supplanted by TLS, which I think has been supplanted again. I don't even know. Yeah. I've lost track. SNI, I think, is now the new hotness.
There is that, yeah, and like new versions of TLS.
It's kind
of, everyone's trying to promote to 1.1.
Yes.
Yeah. So then tell me a little bit about that shift to management, right? Like, I mean, you know, being a programmer and then like having to manage. And I think, you know, we've talked about this in the past, you and me, like, the notion of coding and managing.
Mm-hmm.
How was that shift for you? And you know, what did you kind of challenges and even perhaps now contemplate today doing, you know, managing teams and doing the work at the same time?
It's really hard. I would say the first lesson that everyone I think learns is that you can't do critical blocking work anymore. The context switching costs involved in management are such that you can't reasonably block out entire days of time, because once you become a manager, rather than having one person dictate what they want you to do with your time, you have an entire team that is basically pushing up to you how they think you should be spending your time with them and on them and for them. And so you move from basically tasks where you pull tasks off of a queue to a push style where like you have 7, 10, and in some very sad instances, 15 or 20 people that are all pushing requests at you. So the immediate thing that you notice is that, well, first of all, your calendar explodes with meetings. And keep in mind with every meeting, like we've basically scientifically proven the cost of context switching. You lose roughly somewhere between 15 and 20% of whatever time you did.
Yeah.
So if you go and do something and it took you an hour, it'll take you about 15 to 20% of that time to get back into the mental mode of the other thing you're doing. So if you go into an hour meeting, you've basically blown an hour and 15 to an hour and 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And because the meetings are, you know, well, you have one this time and then, oh, well, this person can only meet at one. And then your next thing you know, your day is sliced up to the point where you can't sit down for 5, 6, 7 hours and just hack on something. So those mental models that you build up over an hour or two, right? You're working on something and it's just like, oh, I've seen the matrix. I know exactly how I need to do all of this stuff, right? Like that takes time to build up. And as we all know, as programmers, somebody does the dreaded shoulder tap, only they're not shoulder taps anymore. They're meeting reminders. They're people, employees popping up on IM. They're, you know, there's other sorts of fires that are happening in other departments that you need to be involved in. So the first thing I tell all the developers, and they all tell me, you know, they all walk away thinking I'm insane, but you have to give up. You can't basically commit to points in the sprints anymore. And if you do, make sure they're points that everybody's comfortable losing, because you will pretty much lose them almost every sprint.
Yeah.
So what I recommend if people, I still think managers can stay close to code, but they have to do it, I think, in a much different way. So even as a manager, I still spent plenty of time in code reviews. I still spend plenty of time reviewing pull requests. I still spend plenty of time looking over, you know, stubbed APIs, whiteboard sessions, that kind of stuff. And when it comes to actual coding, what I like to do is, as a manager, you know what your team's struggling with, and you know where they're kind of frustrated. So what I like to do is focus my coding on giving them tooling. So I had an issue about a year after we started Sprintly. We were wasting a lot of cycles with developers, like pulling down new database dumps and reloading new database dumps. So I created a little script that would pull those down and cache them locally and update them.
Yeah.
That kind of tooling can be very, very helpful. You can write Slack bots, you can write PR bots, you can, you know, there's all sorts of that kind of stuff that you can do that's not critical. And in fairness, actually is a good management thing to do, because your job as a manager is to make your employees happy, successful, and efficient. So I look at automation and tooling as for sure something that makes my employees, I hope, happier and more efficient. The other thing that I think is really good for managers to write, and this is I wouldn't do this if you were a manager of a large team, but if you're like a tech lead or a lead architect, and so you're still pretty relatively close to the code and still heavily involved in that, write tests. You can always write another test. And nobody's going to be unhappy that you wrote another test. I guarantee there's a hotline or two of code somewhere in your app. And when you write tests, you have to have a local working environment. You have to know the code. And you have to know the logic well enough to be able to actually exercise those tests. So those are really kind of automation and tooling and writing tests are the two ways that I'm like, go hog wild. And also context switching is not a big cost on those things, because you write a shell script here, you write a couple tests there. It's really no skin off anybody's back, but don't go and write the next critical feature, because you were going to screw everybody on the team.
that's very good, and probably something I shouldn't be doing right now.
Yeah, go write some tests, Calv.
I'll just stick to the bots and the CI build time.
The one that I really want to write right now is, we have everything automated. We use the Git flow. So we have a develop and a master, and develop pushes to staging and master could push to production. What I want to do is, we use Slack, of course, like everybody else on the planet at this point. When we have a successful build, it pushes into the channel and says, oh, this successful build on this branch. I would love to be able to hit an emoji rocket reaction and just have it deploy that build.
Ah, yes, launch.
Yes, launch this.
Brilliant. Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, so hopefully someday I can get that.
I think we looked at the API for reactions once. They don't expose that, just so you know. Yeah, I know.
I know someone there.
You know someone,
yeah. Someone there. Yeah. My old roommate works there now. I'll go yell at Derek. I
know everyone's roommates work there.
There's so many people here. I mean, so Vancouver here, they have an office here, right? So a number of people are working here.
Yeah.
Interesting. So then tell me, I mean, this is something I'm sure Pat's going to be really interested in. How does design play into the world that you paint today, the product lifecycle of teams? I mean, we just talked about agile design and, you know, Danny Burke, and we've been reading the design sprint stuff a lot and trying to practice that here. But like, what is it? How do you see that play into what you build and work on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, I focus a lot less on how things look these days to how things work. And the one thing, my thinking on this really shifted a while back when I met product guy in San Francisco named Ryan, who was one of the founders of Yard Sale. And their UX, they used all stock iOS stuff. Yep. And I was like, this is just all, I mean, it's amazing, but, you know, it's really fast and everything, like, you know, click, 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 post the kids. And he said two things to me about the design stuff that kind of have really stuck with me. One of them was that he had really kind of, because they were taking on Craigslist, and when he talked to anybody about Craigslist, they were always like, it's such a pain in the ass to post stuff on there. And so early on, him and his co-founder Ed were like, all right, we're going to come up with a golden rule for the UI, which is you have to be able to post something in less than 15 seconds. Now, it didn't really matter what it looked like. Well, Craigslist is the perfect example of it doesn't matter what it looks like, right? And the point that he was making is he's like, you really have to nail that gripe and like fix that. And it doesn't, I mean, it matters to some extent, obviously, what it looks like. And he wasn't releasing this, but he's like, I can always make something pretty, but I can't always make something functional. And so he's focused most of his time, and he's basically flip-flopped, I think, how most people design, or most companies anyway design, which is they make wireframes, and then they hand the wireframes off to the designer. The designer polishes pixels, and then they hand them off to the developer. Right. He started with stock UI, prototyped on that, and kept prototyping on that, which meant the developer could build an actual functioning thing without having to worry about how it looked. And kept iterating on that UX and iterating on that UX until they got to the point where it felt good. And then they basically came in and layered the pretty pixels in over that once they had it in place. And that makes a hell of a lot of sense to me. So I try nowadays to think of, there's a couple of things I try to think of. I try to think of the new kind of thing that I'm really onto and that I think is could be a huge boon to developer or to designers are the kind of component and React movement right now. So I don't think of UI and pixels. I think of really kind of motion and patterns and interactions, and then codify those via components. And then hopefully over time you build up, you know, your own GUI library and you're not having to reinvent the wheel every time. Yeah. So if I was working at a real large company now, and I was remotely involved with the design team, my goal would be to work with the developer team and build out effectively UI toolkit component library in whatever component library framework is the latest on us. Mm-hmm.
I've had a very similar transition in my thinking as well. Just through reading and experience and so forth. I think even Steve Jobs said something along the lines of like, design isn't just how something looks, it's how something works. You think of a pretty classic design principle of affordance, right? Like the reason you make something look the way it does isn't for it to be pretty. Like the prettiness isn't the goal. You design the look of a thing such that someone knows instantly what its purpose is. A perfect example of this, someone on the team gave it a name, and I can't remember what that name is, but if you think of a door, right? pretty standard user interaction, if you will, of opening and closing a door. And I cannot tell you how many doors in this city, at least, and probably cities all over the world, where I have no idea whether I walk up to a door and I have no idea whether to push or pull it. And they sometimes don't say anything. And sometimes they'll even have little signs written in English, which is not very accessible. And so, whereas like it's a solved problem, the door is like, put a handle on the side I want to pull, put a plate on the side that I want to push, and yeah. It's done, and you're done. And you can make that look really good too, like on top of all that.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, and so I really hear what you're saying in terms of like, it's like, don't, I can make something look pretty or I can hire someone to make something look pretty. That's really easy. We have a long tradition in the design world of making things look pretty all the way back to Gutenberg and the first printing press. Right. And yep. So like the graphic design, that side of things, we've got that down. Where designers, I think, have in the past faltered, although I think there's definitely a strong driving trend recently. And I think that your friend Daniel is a part of this, and many others. I think of Ryan Singer at Basecamp and so forth, who are thinking of the user, I hate saying the user experience, but the way that a human being actually experiences and interacts with the thing that you're making. Design sprints are actually really good at, for this aspect.
But of so it. This is what I was going to lead to, right? Like with that door example, it's pretty easy to test, right? You can see someone walk to a door and be confused, push, pull, whatever. It didn't work. So lead me to kind of like, because we agree with that, right? The difficulty we always face though is how do you test that? Like, how do you really know that the value is being retrieved by many users or lots of users? And I mean, you've got some insight on this, I'm sure, right? Like you're running Sprintly, you get people putting in like product value that they want to achieve out of something. And the designers play a part of that. But then how do they know that it worked? Even that Craigslist form or whatever, like how do they know that people are, I mean, obviously that's measurable. You can be like, hey, time to submit was 5 seconds. Great. But then did it increase in the number of postings? Did it actually increase the value of the use of the product? Like, what do you think of that area right now? Do you do anything to test that? Do you even like, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my business partner, so when I bought Sprintly back, I don't know if you saw that, but I bought Sprintly back in October from the original investors and the company that bought it. And my business partner is a Canadian in Toronto. April Dunford. She's an amazing marketing and sales executive. And she is constantly talking to customers. And this is something that I was just at Saster and I saw, who did I see? I think it was the Buffer, the guy from Buffer. And he was talking about, I think it was Barometrics, one of them, whoever is doing the like totally transparent company where they even post like how much the CEO makes. I think that's Buffer too. Yeah. But he said something that blew me away. The company I think is maybe 20 or 30 people right around there. He has 4 people that are dedicated full-time to customer development. Full-time. And which I think is amazing. So the thing that I always find a little bit funny, now granted I work in B2B SaaS, so you know, people are paying me for my stuff. It's not a like, you know, this is in no way a Snapchat, like, oh my God, this thing just blew up out of nowhere kind of thing. It turns out people who pay you money to solve business problems are very upfront about what their problems are and how they would like them solved. Like they're not shy about telling you these things, right? Like if you think of a guy, like think about it, like you're a guy that like extracts oil from the ground and some dude comes and says, well, you know, we can help you extract oil from the ground. How would you like us to do that? And he's like, put something down into the ground and bring the oil back up. I don't care how you do it, right? Like, it's pretty clear. So like, talk to your customers is a very easy, low-hanging fruit that you would be shocked how many people just don't. They just don't. They're like, I have no idea. I released this thing. And then you'll have some support person that's like, every single paying customer is complaining about X. One of us might argue you should build X.
But then how do you go back and verify that you've actually succeeded in solving that problem? Like there's two different sides to this, right?
Yeah.
Getting to the root of that problem, which is tricky and amazing that team has 4 people dedicated to that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it's, I guess, yeah, exactly. So let's just say you've got your users, your business customers saying, okay, fine, I X better. And they've told you that and your best efforts have released something. We're talking qualitative, right? Of course, you can talk to 5 people, but then when you're making a change that affects thousands of people.
Yeah. I like to use retention metrics on that. So if you release a new feature, are people using it? Yes. Are they coming back and using it? Yes. You probably did okay. If you release a new feature and people do use it, but then you see a shark fin and your 60-day retention on that feature plummets, you probably missed the mark. And again, your customers will tell you when you release something and you're off the mark. And when you release stuff and you're on the mark, you'll hear about that too. But generally speaking, I like to see, are they using it? Yes. Are they coming back and using it? And that's the most important thing that I think that's another subtle thing I think a lot of people miss is that retention.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people launch a new thing or an improvement to feature and measure the first initial reaction on it. like, mm-hmm. I mean, I think tools right now work as an anti-pattern towards this. If you look at Intercom, like, it will say measure a goal in relation to an announcement, but will it actually measure the repeated use of a goal afterwards? They don't do that.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting point. Just taking a quick step back, though, right? Lots of people telling you things that's wrong or could be improved or things that they want. How do you know which ones are the right things?
I personally, the way that I like to do this is really at the beginning, you have to establish a thesis about what type of customer you think the software will most resonate with. Okay. For us at Sprintly, that just happens to be small dev and design shops. We think that we resonate pretty well with them. They tend to be the customers that use the crap out of our product. And so once you have established what I would consider kind of your beachhead in the market, so our beachhead, small dev shops, design shops, under 30 employees, they probably have somewhere between 5 and 15 maker people around there, right? That means that I'm going to completely and totally ignore all of the people that are working at IBM using my software right now and managing 300 engineers and telling me that they need Okta Enterprise Identity integration, right? So the way that I like to run product development is you have to first enable, basically identify a cohort. That's really what we're talking about. We're talking about a cohort or a segment of the market that you think you could be successful with. And then when you look at all of your feedback, newsflash, break it down by cohort. So wash out people that are telling you that, you know, like, I'm not really doing anything for people that are open source lone wolf people, and I'm not doing anything for huge enterprise, and I'm not doing anything for small startups. I'm not doing anything for education. I'm just focusing on those folks right there in the dev shops, right? So that's really the primary way that I do that. And then once you've identified the cohort, you'll figure out pretty quickly what the 5, 6, or 7 things are that they want. And then usually at that, it's just a matter of prioritizing based on demand, which is pretty easy to suss out.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good way, I mean, of putting it. I know. So how, I guess here's a question though, like, how often do you revise the cohorts? How often do you, like, you know, I guess you know it today, but at one point you didn't know that. And how did you determine those cohorts? So, I mean, was it simply like, actually, it's pretty obvious that it's just devs, or did you have to perform something to whittle it down to know that it was those?
We bought it back. April spent a lot of time looking through the data. And I know as like engineers, we're supposed to hate all of the business tools that come out, but the four quadrant thing can actually work pretty well for making decisions. And if you plot out, basically, if you think of the magic quadrant is the cohort that has the lowest churn and the highest conversion, that's a market that's probably all about your product. If they convert at a high rate and they churn at a low rate, whatever cohort that is, they like whatever the hell you've built. Now, it may not be the cohort you wanted to build for, and it may not be the features in your product that you like, but that's definitely one way to identify that market segment that you're resonating with. That's also another way to once you've established a beachhead, you can start figuring out how to expand it. And that's when you start looking for folks that convert at a high level, but churn out at a high level, right? For sure. And that's where an opportunity where you could deliver something and capture more of that business.
I just want to mention to the listeners that are all watching, please do fire a question if you want to ask a question to Joe but hopefully they're seeing it in the direction that we are.
I have no idea. Yeah, that's a good point. This is actually mirrored, though.
So slash Q in the message, the live chat box, for any questions. Otherwise, we're just going to keep asking.
Can I follow up that question? Sprintly is particularly fascinating because it's a product that another team that I used to work for used. And we were a startup, so we actually didn't really quite perfectly fit into your current cohort, your focus now. Your team doesn't really fit then into your pre- presumably you're the team that's working on Sprintly, or maybe it's just you at this point right now, but the team developing Sprintly, the people developing Sprintly are not then technically part of that specific cohort. And yet I'm guessing that you're probably still dog fooding your own product.
Yep.
It suits that need as well. How do you make sure that you're focusing then on the cohort's needs more than your own?
I don't build stuff for me. I had a really like blunt conversation with April when she's like, "Well, what do you think our roadmap should be?" And I was like, "It's real simple, April. You just tell me what you can sell, and I'll build it. I can build whatever you want, but you tell me what will make money." And that maps back to finding a segment that likes your customer, you know, likes your thing, and then just giving them love and really making the product sing for them.
So with that thinking then, what do you say to those that say build something that you're passionate about, that you can connect with? And this is more of a founder question. That people like say, hey, you have to really care about this. It's going to get you up in the morning and you really need to understand that customer base.
Yeah. I had a buddy that I think put this best, which was basically like, you really have to care about the problem and focus not on the solution. Because at the end of the day, sometimes customers just want to hit a button and download a CSV. As much as that just drives all of us insane.
That and spreadsheets, yeah.
Yes, right? Like they want a CSV so they can put it into a spreadsheet. And I just want you to tell me what you're doing in the spreadsheet so I can make a feature for it. Well, sometimes people don't care. They just want a CSV or a button to download something, right? So I think that's probably like the number one thing that I tell. Hold on, I got a dog that's screaming. Give me 1 second.
I wasn't sure if it was a dog or a monkey. I started hearing like.
She looks like a monkey.
Okay.
Yeah, she's an Affen pincher, and Affe in German means ape. Well,
there you go. I was pretty close.
She does kind of sound like a monkey, but.
So that's
this is the number one. Yeah. This is what I always tell the founders, though, is that Sprintly is not the product I set out to build. It has long surpassed what I ever expected to build into it. And there are definitely features that if you had asked me when I first started building Sprintly, I would have been like, there is no effing way I will ever build something like that.
Right.
And yet they exist because at the end of the day, you have to make a decision. Do you just care about making something that's shiny and satisfies your own itch? Or do you really give a shit about whatever problem you're working on? And if you really care about whatever problem you're working on, you're going to add CSV download buttons and you're going to respond to customer needs.
Yeah, that's definitely a good way of putting it. And I think I'm going to steal that from you, Joe.
Well, steal from Adil Wally. He was the one that said it to me.
So I've got a bunch of other questions here, but I kind of wanted to flip it. Like, what's on your mind these days? Like, what is the topics that you're thinking about that, you know, we can't even be asking you questions because we don't know. Like, what are the challenges you're facing right now at Sprintly and with product management and getting high quality products out there?
There's definitely a lot of opportunity right now, I feel, for tooling in this space. Product people spend a lot of time of attempting to synthesize qualitative signals.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I would love a natural language processing robot that sifted through my support queue and told me what types of customers were complaining about what types of things. That would be amazing. That's something that I spend a lot of time thinking about because I do a lot of this product work as a consultant as well. And a lot of it is literally just going through one support request and one exit survey after another. And it drives me insane. It's very tedious work. As far as broader stuff goes, things are getting a little scary in tech right now, I think, like as far as what's now possible. This is something that I think about. I don't know. Maybe it's just I'm getting older. My friends are having kids and stuff now. But like
at the paranoia stage of your life.
Oh yeah, for sure. Like when I tell family members, I was like, look, you can take for about 2 to $3,000-ish You can take off-the-shelf components and build a face recognition autonomous drone armed that will just fly around and shoot people who have the letter Q on their shirt or something, yeah. Right?
Well, we should be getting those people. Let's be
honest. Should, yes, yes. So, like, the thing that I think about is, like, someone is going to do that. And then I'm kind of a politics and law junkie. So I'm like, there's going to be some crazy case laws like being developed. Like, so like if you make an autonomous drone that's able to make its decisions on its own and then shoot things, like yeah. Who's responsible?
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Have you read there was a recent article about the legalities towards bots. Have you read this?
No, but please share it with the class.
I'll put it in the show notes. I'll send it to you afterwards.
Okay.
And it referenced a case where a bot was running on Twitter and it referenced to kill someone. Like, it just kind of, obviously, you know, sort and whatever. So it threatened someone to murder them. And then became a court case or whatever and, like, became, like, a big deal. But then they had the court had to drop it because there was no one to actually prosecute. Whereas the creators of the project were actually saying, we're responsible. No, you actually have to continue legally progressing towards. Because that was the point of their project. Their research project was to see, like, what is the legalities.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's definitely on point with this topic. That, like,
yeah. There was an artist in the EU that also they created a bot that would randomly buy drugs off of the dark net.
Yeah, and
yep.
He went and bought loads of illegal and whatever else, and got busted. And the computer got arrested. Right? Is that what happened? From what I remember, like literally, they knocked down the door and took away the computer that ran the bot.
Yeah, yeah. So it's that is really weird and strange. And I think that we're only really starting to scratch the surface of this, like, you know, it's only been in the last, really, since the smartphones came out, that technology, that the software that we use and that we've been developing leapt into the real world. Like, all of a sudden it was controlling stuff around us. And, you know, I had I don't know where I was at, but some product guy was basically like, these are basically remote controls for real life now. So, like, you can change channels and hit mute and call cars and, like, do all sorts of crazy stuff. And it's just so nascent. Like, we're not even – we're probably 100 years away from realizing the chaos that we are actually causing right now. The first person on the planet just felt texture with a fake fingertip that was embedded in their finger.
Really?
Yeah, I just saw that. So – crazy tech, crazy, like, it's tech that, you know, I'm sure all the Brewhouse people are super smart, super advanced, like, programmers
and handsome.
But the reality is we're like, we have like room temperature IQs compared to the tech that's being pushed out the door now.
Yeah. Oh yes.
Yeah.
No. I'm pretty scared of, like, some of the AI stuff. Like, I just moved all my photos to Google Photos and how it can face recognition from my kids to baby faces to, like, their now 6-year-old face. That's insane.
Yeah.
We, like, wonder, like, well, okay, they can do that. What?
Well, that's so that when Tom Cruise walks through the set of Minority Report, the advertisements know.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Address him, right?
Mm-hmm.
So. It's an interesting topic because I think, you know, the other thing is have you ever thought about data and where it's being stored and whether we're going to reference it in the future?
Yeah. One of the things that, and I guess that this was actually a plot for a movie, but one of the things I've been thinking about for years is, like, am I going to get rehydrated in some robot based on, like, my email history in 100 or 200 years? Because that would be terrifying to, like, wake up in a computer and people are like, hey, Joe. And you're like, what's going on? I thought I was dead. And they're like, well, we rehydrated your brain from all your social media and then your email account. I'd be like,
so you should prepare for that by writing yourself an email right now. Saying, if you're reading this, and you, yeah.
Yeah, please do not rehydrate me later from my data.
So we have do not resuscitate orders currently.
Yes, right? Do not AI me.
Yeah.
Do not data mine me later.
Okay, so there's a question. Is that an opt-in or an opt-out?
Because
we could go back. We don't need emails. We could go back and read like letters from hundreds, if not thousands of years ago and start to create a profile of people from then. They had no idea that this was possible, and yet we could give it to them, right? And essentially would be against their consent.
Yeah, it has to be opt-in, right? I mean, that feels highly unethical to me.
John Lennon or, Jesus of Nazareth or Joe Stump, right?
Oh, man. Well, if they have no guitarists in the future, then they can go ahead and bring Joe Stump back.
We might just do the wrong one because the Google hit might hit the wrong person there, Joe.
That's true.
Yeah, they try to bring Joe Stump back, and he just like wakes up and is like, guys, this is wrong. We need to shut this down.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah,
you need to stop this right podcast now. I did years, centuries ago.
Yeah. It'd be like Fry on Futurama.
So while we go in the call, I'm gonna quickly shift on one last quick topic to end it off. Startups, you know, you're an active investor. You're involved a lot in kind of the technology scene and have been for a while and observed so many different shifts. What's cool to you in the year ahead, and what's worrying about that? Because I guess you are, I'm tapping into your paranoia there a little bit, but you know, the concerns of founders and startups in the year ahead.
I think that winter is coming, much like most people do on the funding side. But I think that's going to be a real opportunity for a lot of bootstrappers. I think that there's going to be a pretty big glut of money-generating SaaS startups that will probably come onto the market and be available in both fire sales or just to take over. So if there are folks out there that are looking for opportunities, I suspect that you'll be able to buy SaaS products that are making $5,000 to $10,000 a month for probably less than what you'd get a house for or less. That's really exciting to me. We're finally making real money on the internet, and there's finally a real clear path to independence for a lot of folks. So if I was an engineer at a SaaS company that was turning over $10,000 or $20,000 a month and probably wasn't growing very fast, I'd be figuring out a way that I could buy that from the investors. I think the IPOs are going to be real slow for a while, which is sad. Probably not until the next cycle. I think Uber probably won't IPO until maybe even 2020 at this point.
Is that an accurate comment there, Joe?
I don't know. I don't talk to anybody at Uber, so I don't know nothing about nothing there. I don't know nothing about nothing. I don't live in San Francisco anymore. I'm very far away from the grapevine on that one. But what I do know is that China is pooping itself right now, and that is completely, totally roiling all of everything. And then the story that they're not really talking about with regards to China is there's this huge, the president has been cracking down on corruption big time, and not just the little guys, like the people that are skimming tens of millions and billions off the top. Like, they just had a billionaire in China just disappear. Like, so between that and the economic turmoil, there's capital flight going on. But China's now implementing capital flight controls. So if you're an IPO, like, and Uber has massive Asia operations, any tech company that has massive Asia operations, you're not selling the family funds in China in an IPO for the next couple of years, at least. Wow. It's going to be not good. That's why Bitcoin had the huge run up. It's because for a while they were using Bitcoin as a capital flight mechanism.
So here's a question then on that. How long of a cycle, when you say next cycle, in your view, what is a cycle in the time frame? Is it, are you talking 3 to 5 years? Are we, you know, what's your perspective?
Most financial cycles tend to be 7 to 10 years, and we're 8 years into this last one, and they're basically a cycle is bust to bust, basically. It's the this in between the bus. That's one cycle.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, it's really, you know, we're going through a big correction at the market in general, although the Dow's on a 4-day tear right now.
Quick advice to founders actually founding today. What would you say to them?
Cut costs or gather as much capital as you can.
Okay.
It's time to build up that war chest.
It's time. Yeah. It's time to batten the hatches and build up the war chest, I would say.
Do you think the timing of Game of Thrones actually is going to coincide with winter, really winter?
That would be amazing. Yeah, that would be real good.
When the season ends, and like winter is here, and then all of a sudden, like,
yeah. There's one other thing in tech that's really exciting to me right now, and I've actually started building a product, and you actually touched on it earlier. The APIs that are now available to do big data stuff on demand are insane. Like Google, that thing, Google has the Google Vision API. You can post a picture to it and it'll post back OCR and things it's identified in the product in the picture. Yeah. So like I've been building a new note app. And so like you can, it does full OCR on everything. Oh. And then it'll tell you like what it thinks it's looking at. You know, Embedly is a really good API for getting a bunch of information about URLs. Mm-hmm. Google has a ton of them. Amazon and AWS has a whole machine learning one. IBM bought Alchemy, which has all sorts of classification and sentiment analysis. These things are all available over an HTTP call now.
I have a friend who's doing some work with the IBM Watson API, doing voice to text.
Yeah. You can ask it like questions and stuff. I mean, I suspect probably maybe 1 to 3 WWDCs away from Siri having an open API. Echo has an open API. So this whole notion that extremely advanced computing is available to people as dumb as me is really exciting to me.
Yeah, it is to me too. And that's a topic on itself we can talk about for a long time. I think the notion of invisible apps or deploying to those types of services versus deploying to a web page now is a real interesting shift that I think we're heading towards. And I guess with those AI aspects and these APIs, what do you think are going to be the businesses or industries that first take advantage of them, though? Like, you know, because it really becomes the application, the use that really takes off versus like, you know, oh, this is clever. Look, I can break up a sentence and know a time or a date and an object or whatever. Like, but really, how is it really going to be used?
I have no idea, to be totally honest. I mean, we've seen a lot of this already. I mean, to be totally honest, we use this every day when we type a search into Google. We use it every day when we upload our photos to Facebook and it says, hey, is this Cal? And you're like, yeah, creepy Facebook, it is Cal. So we are using it a lot. Like, to be honest, and this is going to, you guys are going to laugh about this, but probably one of the coolest pieces of tech I've seen in action, and I actually, it's made me use the product more, is Snapchat lenses. They're phenomenal. That's a phenomenal piece of, oh man, you haven't seen these things? They're so much fun. Basically, I don't know if you can see this, but you can't.
No.
When you look at, when you're in a face chat or Snapchat, you can push on someone's face and it puts this like grid around it. And then these different faces pop up and you can record with like rainbows coming out of your eyes or like a big dog tongue coming out and stuff. And it works really well. Like you can even like move your mouth around and like there's one of them where you raise your eyebrows and like fire comes out of your, lightning bolt comes out of your eyes or whatever.
I did it on Halloween with my kids.
Yeah.
Funny, like just like taking video pictures of their faces where it was, they looked like a werewolf or something. It was,
yeah.
So I have Snapchat open right now.
Yeah.
What do I do to get that thing?
So point it at your face.
My face.
And then tap on it. And if you tap and hold, you'll get this like weird grid. And then you can pull up different things. So right now I have a Gear VR Oculus over my eyes and I can like move around.
We've lost Pat now.
Yeah. See, you got the dog face.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? Like, the technology behind that is pretty complicated.
That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. I worked at a company that did work just with face detection.
Yeah.
This is like a billion miles beyond that. Like, that's insane.
I know, and it's in a chat app for teenagers.
Yeah.
Right?
it's one-upping emoji icons, I'll tell you that, right?
So yeah.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Furries are super into this.
That app is all deployed on Google Apps as well, or Google App Engine. Or at least it was for the first multi-billion-dollar offer or two.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a great way to highlight a product of the week we tend to do on our podcast. We'll talk about Snapchat's. What was it? Lens? Is that? I didn't know they called it Lens as a feature.
Yes, Snapchat Lenses is what the. Yeah, they had a lens store, and then they yanked it pretty quick. Hmm. And now they just have they rotate the lenses in and out, and they have sponsored lenses and stuff like that.
So we haven't had any questions. So no one decided to punch in /Q and ask a question. So we'll just pretty much end it.
We'll wrap it up. Let you get back to crushing it.
Nice. Oh, be excited.
Somebody is ready to ask a question. So
you better get on it right now.
Press /Q and then type in your message and it will pop up on a question on the other side.
Here it comes. This is going to be amazing.
Is it going to be amazing?
It's going to be either amazing or it's going to be not that good.
All right, we'll find out.
Top 3 tips for self-motivation.
There you go.
Oh, man. I'm terrible at this. I'm like the worst procrastinator. I'll make it one. Thanks for being easy on me, man. the one thing that I do that has been there's been two things I think that have been helpful for me when it comes to motivating and being focused. One of them, and these, I don't know if these are helpful, but one of them is to not check your email before noon. And the other one is to put calendar invites into your calendar for when you want to work on your stuff. So I block out time in my calendar where I'm like, I'm going to code on Sprintly, or I'm going to go work on my other weird side project for 4 or 5 hours. And that gives me that time to where I can kind of sit down and know that I'm not going to have, you know, like some sort of distraction or something like that.
Makes so much more sense now. Now I know why Joe never replies to my emails in the morning. I'll send him at noon.
Yeah, exactly. I have a friend who advocates a very similar idea where you block out those times, the times that you want to remove distractions.
Yeah. The other thing that I did a while ago, I know this is kind of like cheesy and kitschy, I guess, but I was one of the many people that read the 4-Hour Work Week, and he talks about the information diet. And I used to be a complete RSS addict, like RSS and Twitter, and just like consume all the information. I killed them all. And that was a big boost in productivity. Was really just kind of saying, I'm going to check the New York Times and Daring Fireball, and that's really all I care about.
Yeah.
I've just got rid of my Apple Watch this week for that same reason.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I keep on wanting to read everything and see everything, and it's like, actually, that's turning into a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, we got one more, and we'll end it on that. Okay, so gaining traction. I find it very hard, and in my early business day, to gain traction.
Yeah, it is always difficult.
Yeah, and it doesn't get any easier.
No, because once you get up to 15,000 in recurring revenue, you need to get up to 30, and then you need to get up to 50. You know, as far as gaining traction, really the best thing I know is really word of mouth. That's what's worked consistently and repeatedly. That's what scales. And so, you know, I've seen this in my own products at Sprintly. And I've definitely seen it when people talk about this, about other products. If you respond quickly to customer issues when you first launch a product, they'll talk about it. Like, we just turned around, a guy reported a bug, and we turned around a bug for him in, like, I don't know, 3 hours or something like that. From the time he tweeted it to the time I merged the PR in and replied to his thing, it was like 3 hours. And that dude was over the moon. Like, they, like, people are blown away when they, you know, email a faceless website and are like, hey, I tried this thing. This thing kind of sucked. Can you make it a little bit better? And then an hour or two later, you're like, yeah, it's all better now. That's definitely a...
Are we talking like referrals then there as a channel, like as a distribution channel, referrals, working on referrals, or are we talking just generally word of mouth positive kind of...
I would say do things that encourage people to talk about your product. And one thing that I've noticed that will get people to talk about your product is to respond to their needs quickly. That being said, as far as, you know, how can you pump up word of mouth? For sure. You know, like, I've seen everything in early days. I've seen everything from extend your trial automatically for another 30 days if you tweet out about us. I've seen, you know, the refer a friend and we'll give you a free month. You know, so there's a bunch of stuff that you can do around word of mouth to encourage that. And I'm sure there's a bunch of other options as well. The things that I would definitely avoid early on when you're trying to gain traction is paid acquisition. The problem with early paid acquisition is you usually don't really know what you've built yet. Like, you know that you built something for somebody, but you really don't know who's going to end up using it and liking it, which usually means you're going to waste money on ads. And then the other problem is you don't really know what your metrics are and what your funnel looks like. It would be really bad to put money into a funnel that looked like this. It's really good to put money into a funnel that looks like this.
For sure.
Yeah.
And you probably don't have money and shouldn't spend on money.
Yeah. Well, yes, there's that too.
Very, very good advice there. Thank you very much, Joe.
For your time. Yeah.
It was a pleasure meeting you.
Oh, pleasure meeting you too. And hopefully we'll have some pepper and Parmesan cheese donuts at some point.
Yes. Oh, yes. The Cartems he's talking about.
Oh, yeah. So,
he knows about the Vancouver Cartem donuts.
I love those.
We'll make sure to have them when you come visit the Brewhouse office.
Sounds great.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Joe.
And yeah, thank you, guys.
Listening. It was a lot of fun, and we will do this again soon.
Sounds great.
All right. Take care.
Bye.